Welcome to Great Minds, as after five seasons, we wind up what has been a wonderful joyride with a true icon, someone I've known about for years, never imagined that I would get a chance to talk to you, Shelley. With us today is one of the most influential people who has ever lived in the music business. And when you hear Shelley Berger's story, you will understand that if anything, what I'm saying is an understatement. Since 1966, Shelley has been the manager of The Temptations, a partnership, Shelley, I can only think of John Landau and Bruce Springsteen as another duo that have had the magical ride that you have had with The Temptations and with Otis Williams in particular. Going way back, I know you also played a big role with The Supremes. We're going to talk about Berry Gordy and so much more. But first and foremost, Shelley, I can't thank you, Josh, Linda, the Berger family, for making this happen and the chance to have you here on Great Minds. So a most, most heartfelt welcome, Shelley.
Thank you so very, very much, Matthew.
So, Shelley, let's go back to 1966 and to the very beginning. Can you tell me the story of how you and Berry Gordy connected and sort of what happened from that magical moment?
Okay, well, it started in 1965. I was working for a management company. I was running a management company in California, and it was called Scandori and Shane. And we managed Don Rickles, and we managed a bunch of young rock, Dick and Dee Dee, the Kingsmen, the Dovells, a bunch of rock acts. And one day I was having a meeting at the William Morris Agency, and as I was walking through the door for my meeting, the agent, John Hartman, was on the telephone and said, I would not be interested, but you know who would be great would be Shelley Berger. And he hung up the phone. I sat down. I said, what was that all about? He said, have you ever heard of Motown? I said, are you kidding? KGFJ is my favorite station, which is the R&B station in L.A. I said, what about them? He said, they're looking to open an office in Los Angeles and they're looking for someone to run it. And a few days later, I got a telephone call from someone at Motown who said he would like to meet. It was the general counsel for Motown. We met and we had meetings probably for 7 months. And finally, we agreed to a deal, and I started at Motown in June of 1966.
Absolutely amazing. And talk about the first conversations with Berry. I know you're still dear friends to this day. Both of you, thank God, in good health and strong as ever. But take us back to that very beginning, those very first conversations after you got past the general counsel.
You see, Motown at that time had about 7 or 8 houses. It was a residential area. And those 7, 8 houses, one being next to a funeral parlor, that was the studio comprised, that was the Motown offices. And the only way you could get information back and forth to people was a loudspeaker system across West Grand Boulevard, which was down the street from the General Motors building, down the street from the Fisher Theater. So I had just come to Detroit for my first meeting. I'd never met Berry Gordy. And I was kind of thinking that maybe there wasn't a Berry Gordy, that it was some kind of a godlike figure that drove all these people, because everyone who I met was just so incredibly committed to this company. All of a sudden, I'm walking down the street and I hear on the loudspeaker, Shelley Berger, come to Mr. Gordy's office. So I go, whoa, okay. I thought at that time, I didn't know that you were taking your life in your hands going to that office. I just thought it was a nice chat up and he was going to say hi. So I went to the office and I sat down and he said to me, why did we hire you? What have you ever done? So I gave him my background. He said, well, let me ask you a question. Do you think you could get our artists on television? And I said, Mr. Gordy, not only will I get our artists on television, but we are going to do our own television specials. And one day we're going to do our own movies. And one day they're going to do a documentary on Motown. At which point he excused himself from the meeting, rang the man who hired me, Ralph Seltzer, and said, fire him. And Ralph Seltzer said, okay, I'll fire him. Is there any reason? He said, well, either he's on drugs or he's the biggest BS artist I ever heard. And Ralph said, okay, but you know, he just set up a TV show where Motown artists are going to be the only artists for 1 hour on television. It was on a show called Where the Action Is. Mr. Gordy said, okay, I'll tell you what, don't fire him yet. We'll fire him after the TV show. I don't know anything is going on. And I get a telephone call the next day. Mr. Gordy would like Chris Clark on this TV show. Chris Clark was a female artist that we had who was white. And so now I called up the producers of the show and I said, look, we have to put this young lady, Chris Clark, on the show. And I was told, no, the show is set. We can't put anybody else on the show. I said, look, it's very important to Mr. Gordy. I just got this job and she's white. And they said, oh, okay, if she's white, okay, we'll put her on the show. So a few days later, we do the television show and we had every Motown artist, but the Supremes on the show, but no Berry Gordy. And after the show has finished shooting, and it's Chris Clark's time to come and do the show, here comes Berry Gordy with Chris Clark. And as they are blocking Chris Clark, I'm not a big person for body language and stuff like that, but I watched the way he's walking back and forth, and and he seemed disturbed. And I walked up to him and I said, Mr. Gordy, is there a problem? And he said, well, how exactly are they going to shoot her? I said, well, why don't I get the producer over here and you can have a chat with him? Because the producer was a good buddy of mine. And so I brought him over. I said, Jerry, this is Berry Gordy. Jerry said, Mr. Gordy, I'll tell you what, why don't I take you into the director's booth and you can tell them exactly what you want. And he looked at me like, what is it with this guy? That show went off and Ralph Seltzer rang him the next day and said, should I fire him? And he said, well, no, don't fire him yet. Just give me a few more weeks. So a couple of weeks later, I get a telephone call. Mr. Gordy's in Las Vegas at the Flamingo with the Supremes, and he would like you to come up for a meeting. So I go to Las Vegas, and I go into his room to have a meeting with him. And he's on the telephone with an agent, with the Supremes agent. He says to me, do you know Norman Weiss? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, he says he has this date for the Supremes and it's top dollar, but I have to give him an answer now. So what do you think? And I said, well, I think if you have to give him an answer now, the answer is no, because the Supremes are the biggest act in America. And if you have to be pushed into an answer. So again, he starts looking at me like, who is this guy? But he gets on the telephone and says, and repeats what I told him. And for the first time, Norman Weiss says, oh, well, look, if you can take as much time as you want, but if I could get some idea. And he said, yeah, I'll let you know. So now we're having a nice chat. And I said, Mr. Gordy, a person who I was managing is working in the lounge at the Sahara Hotel, a comedian. And I think you will think he's very funny, but he's a different kind of comedian. He said, oh, yeah, sure. Why? We'll take the Supremes tomorrow night after their second show. So after the second show, we went over to the Sahara, and I had called Don and said, I'm bringing Berry Gordy and the Supremes. And of course, he played the whole show. And Diana Ross was getting so incensed that she was getting up and wanted to leave. And Berry Gordy sat her down and said, this guy is the funniest man I have ever heard in my life. From that night on, he said to me, well, we'll meet tomorrow. I said, well, I was going to go back home. I haven't brought any clothes or anything like that. And he said, well, can't you call your wife and have your wife bring up some clothes and you spend the weekend? Well, the weekend turned into about 10 days. And I like to say that was the time that the love affair started. And here we are in 2024, and it hasn't ended yet.
What an incredible story. The Don, of course, Don Rickles, amazing, Shelley. So let me be smart here and just ask short, simple questions and give you the ball to run, because you're so, it's just so brilliant to hear all this and really mind-blowing. Go back to early days, the Temptations. I love Ain't Too Proud. As your son Josh knows, I think I probably saw it more than anybody in the world. I went a dozen times between New York and London and absolutely loved it. Go back to the beginning with Otis and the original four. I want to talk about the challenges that the original four all had, but I loved your description of seeing Ain't Too Proud come to Broadway as almost an out-of-body experience for you.
Look, I mean, the Broadway theater to me was always the Vatican. I mean, I went to performing arts high school, was graduated from there. I worked for the number one press agent on Broadway, a man named Arthur Cantor, who was one of the most brilliant people I'd ever met and probably taught me more about the theater and television, et cetera. And I was 16 years old. So that was always the ultimate to me. And to start in 1966 with the Temps and in the entertainment business at that time, to go to Ain't Too Proud was not even, when I said to Berry Gordy that day that we would do our own TV specials and we would do our own movies and there would be a documentary, all of that happened, but I never even considered that we would be on Broadway, that we would be in the theater, that we would be doing a book show in the theater.
Shelley, I'd love to go back to the very beginning, talk about Otis, and talk about the original four, Paul, Melvin, David, and Eddie, and what an original four it was. Incredible, incredible musical group.
Or as Billboard, you know, when they did a study of 60 years, the number one rhythm and blues artist in history.
Be
Otis, always a very special relationship to this very day. Can we dig into the relationship that you have with Otis, which is just extraordinary?
Well, it was a very, very easy relationship. The two men who basically kept the temptations on the rails and handled most of the business/career stuff were Otis and Melvin. They were like partners. And so I dealt with both of them. And it was just a very, very easy relationship, which is the best that I can say about it from the very beginning.
And David in particular, extraordinarily talented, but really, really challenged in life in general, and you know, left us way too soon.
Well, they all left way too soon, but I mean, David did that to himself. You know, I mean, Eddie was taken by cancer. I mean, David by his lifestyle wound up losing his life because of it.
And one of the great lines from the show, and I think it paraphrases something that Barry had said, sometimes the temp, I think I'm not going to get the line right, Shelley, you will, but sometimes the temp and temptation stood for temporary. And
that was a notice line. That wasn't a Barry line.
And referred to just how many people have been in the group, but from David Ruffin to Dennis Edwards, from Paul to Richard Street, the songs, everything to this very day just continues to live and breathe, you know, every bit of fire it did when it was first recorded all those years ago.
That you've got to give Otis his props, because he picked each and every one, from Elvidge Bryant, who was there before David Ruffin. Otis has a great feel for artists, for people, and they may not have stayed with the Temptations for one reason or another, but 27 times he's not been wrong, because there is no time that someone can say, well, I saw them in the 90s and they weren't that good. They were always that good, just that the face has changed.
Amazing. And let's go back to something that we touched on lightly before we started recording. And that's, you know, the Temptations, and part of what you did was take the band from being just enormous in the black community, but you made them a crossover act. You put them on NBC with the Supremes, so much more. And it was an interesting time. I remember talking to Marshall Chess on Great Minds a few years ago, and he told the story of how Chuck Berry's Maybelline became the first, what they then used to call a race record, that made its way onto white radio. You helped navigate that change, breaking down those cultural barriers. Talk about that time in America. And in many ways, Shelley, we're still where we were back then in this country, going all those years ago to the 60s.
There's no question about it. You know, yes, things have changed, and in some ways things are better, but I believe at the core of it, there is still that innate racism in America. And I think it shows itself every day. But you see, it was, I think, easier to get a black artist played on pop stations because the audience didn't have to deal with them. You know what I mean? You just, the record was good, the singing was good, whatever, and you could play it. But going to a club, going to a concert to see a black artist as opposed to a white artist, it's a different experience, because you are dealing with a mixed audience.
One of the things that we've talked about time and time again over the years, I talked about it with Steve Cropper, who is the original guitarist in Booker T and the MGs. The whole Memphis soul scene was so different. It was black and white together. So many of the audiences for the bands when you were on those way back when, those early Motortown or Motown reviews, when all the artists, Smokey and the Temps, and so many more would be on that bus traveling around the country doing live shows, the audience was predominantly white. The artists couldn't necessarily stay in white hotels. They had to stay in rooming houses in the
If
South.
you were below the Mason-Dixon line, yes.
Yeah, but talk about that juxtaposition, Shelley. You have such perspective, and you were there and saw it all.
It was what it was. It was a part of life at that time. But by time the Supremes became the Supremes and the Temptations became the Temptations and were crossing over, we basically could pretty much stay wherever we wanted to stay anywhere in America, because that was the middle 60s towards the later 60s.
As things had started to change. Amazing. Let's talk about England, Shelley. I know you love it, and I happen to share something I saw attributed to you, which is that in many ways the English have a greater appreciation in many ways for American artists than we do here in America. Can we talk about that and early remembrances of tours and bringing the band over to England, many of the acts, but of course starting with the Temptations?
Well, you see, America, I've always referred to as the fast food society. You could be a star and a year later you're not a star, or you 5 years later you're not a star. In England, you become a star, you're a star forever. They do not forget. And they are such incredible fans. They know the words to every song that you sing. Their children know the words to every song that you sing. It's just an entirely different experience.
Amazing. We saw a couple years ago Frankie Valli, and it was at Royal Albert Hall, which is about 5 or 6,000. And I remember seeing a date with your band, the Temptations and the Four Tops, at the O2, the arena, akin to your where the Lakers play, where in your hometown, or where the Knicks, play Madison Square
Oh,
Garden
I
in
know the
mine.
O2.
Yeah, no, of course you do. You wouldn't see the Temps and the Tops playing an arena in America today, but you do in England. And I think that really, in so many ways, validates everything that you just said.
You understand that in America, the Supremes and the Temptations and the Jackson Five were playing arenas in the 60s. So that is nothing new. As a matter of fact, the Supremes were the first act to have a sellout at the Forum in Inglewood, and 2 weeks later, the Temptations were appearing. And the day of the show, I was walking around the Forum and I said to the promoter, "Do you have an extra row of chairs that you could put in here anywhere?" He says, "Well, I think there's a row of six seats." I said, "Why don't you put that in there and sell those six seats so I can say that the Temptations broke the Supremes record at the Forum?"
That's a
Which
great
we did.
story. That's a great story. So, Shelley, you have so many stories. It's almost impossible to ask questions for someone who's such a quintessential storyteller, with so many iconic characters. But when you have those quiet moments and you're laying awake at night or, you know, talking about old times with family, are there particular artists and stories or, you know, little bumps along the way, perhaps, that you remember most fondly?
No, not, there was so much, look, above my bed, okay, there is a framed poster of Diana Ross from the Royal Albert Hall that was sold out. Next to that is a painting entitled Berry Gordy's Berry Vision, where all of the people who were involved with Motown through the years are in this painting. Next to that is a poster of the Supremes from the Lincoln Center from 1965. Just down the hallway into the living room is a painting of Otis and the 27 guys who were members of the Temptations. So, you know, I live with those memories. Again, in my bedroom, you know, there's a picture of a photograph of Diana Ross, Marvin Gaye, Ashford and Simpson, and me in a recording studio while Diana and Marvin were recording their album together. So, I mean, there were so many things that happened, so many moments that happened in my time at Motown. It's very, very, very difficult for me to say, oh boy, and then there was that moment,
you've given us some incredible gems to that end already. I understand exactly what you mean. The body of work is just so expansive and so endless. As we start to wrap, you know, looking back on those early days, you never imagined the Broadway show, but you said something, Shelley, that, you know, going back to that conversation with Berry Gordy, where you sort of outlined a vision for what you would do, you know, with Motown, and it all happened. There's not a lot of people who can say that.
Well, yeah, it all happened. And when you know, the documentary at that time, that the closest we got to the documentary is when we did Motown 25 for ABC. And BG wanted me to be interviewed for that show. And I was telling the story and I said, remember when I said to you at our first meeting, we were going to do our own television specials, we were going to do our own movies, and one day they were going to do a documentary about Motown. Well, this is the closest documentary. So now everything I said that day came true and you were going to fire me. And he said, I wasn't going to fire you. And I said, you're full of crap. I will tell you one other thing. When Barack Obama was president, they set up at the White House a Motown night. And we were, you know, BG and myself and Smokey and Otis and Stevie were at the White House for this. And BG said to me, well, what do you think of that? I said, I have to tell you, when I told you what I told you that first day, I sure as shit didn't think we were going to the White House.
That's fantastic. What a story, and a great one to end on. Shelley Berger, many, many more years of good health. You have produced some wonderful children. I love your boy Josh, and Linda's been a delight to deal with here to help us put this little conversation together. And I look forward to coming out to LA and with Josh and having a meal with you and seeing your smiling face in person.
I can't wait, Matthew.
Thank you, Shelley.
Okay, pal.